Right, so the goal today is to construct examples of fully local or fully extended topological field theories using higher Morita theories. So I'll write that on the board. Cool. So fully local or extended TFTs from higher Morita theory. Okay, so I think my co-author Noah likes fully local, prefers to say fully local rather than fully extended because of this issue that you never know whether you're talking about extending up or extending down. It's kind of ambiguous. Fully local means that it's determined by the local data. So, okay, fully local TFTs. Let me just give an example of what I mean. So recall, the Morita 2 category. So this is kind of an example of a extended field theory coming from Morita theory. So the Morita 2 category, I'll just denote alg, say over some field K, so its objects are just algebras, so associative algebras over K. The one morphisms between two algebras A and B are bimodules. Okay, and then the two morphisms are bimodule homomorphisms. Okay, and that tells you the sets, and then the compositions are, as I'm sure you all know, there's a monoidal structure where we just tensor together two algebras, so it defines a symmetric monoidal structure. And the composition, so composition of two morphisms is obvious, it's just composition of the homomorphisms, and the composition here is the relative tensor product. So if I have an AB bimodule and a BC bimodule, I tensor them over B, and that's now a BC bimodule. Okay. So a basic example of a TFT would be a functor Z from the two-dimensional Bordism category, either framed or oriented, to alg. Okay. And so let me just remind you briefly, so the objects here, this is just either a framed or oriented point. So stably framed points, so there's just two of those. So this gets sent to some algebra object A. And let's see, so the one morphisms are, again, stably framed. So the same thing, one manifolds. Okay, so instead of point, I should have said zero manifolds. And then the two morphisms are surfaces. All right, so, well, I won't give formulas for what the basic one manifold and surfaces go to, but there are well-known formulas for those. I'll just say that, so here, so this A that we pick in alg is, okay, so we need to be finite dimensional and semi-simple, or if we're working in characteristic P, separable. So let me just, for simplicity, just talk about the characteristic zero situation. And this is if we want it to give us a framed theory, and it should be symmetric Frobenius. If we want an oriented theory. So before I go on, should I say any more about any of these words, framed or oriented or Frobenius? I'm quite happy to. No? Okay. No? Okay, yes, okay, great. Yes, oh, it takes one vote, yes. So framed, a manifold is framed if we've trivialized its tangent bundle. So it's extra. It's choice of extra data we impose on the manifold. It's oriented if we just chosen an orientation class. One of the things, finite dimensional and semi-simple, I think, is fine. Frobenius algebra means that A is equipped with a trace to the ground field. So the trace function satisfies some properties like trace of AB equals trace of BA. And we want this to be a non-degenerate symmetric pairing. So it's some extra linear algebraic data that we have to prescribe. So the reason I wanted to recall this basic example is that, so you notice here the framed condition is a strong finiteness. Condition. So when we're talking about algebras, there's no reason to restrict to finite dimensional algebras or semi-simple algebras. But if we want to, if we want to get a theory at all, if we want to get started with a fully local theory, we have to start with something which has the strong finiteness conditions of being finite dimensional and semi-simple as an algebra. And then for the oriented theory, on top of that, so oriented is in general more conditions, but it's also more structure. So some algebras are admit a symmetric Frobenius algebra, and some don't. In this case, all the ones here do, but in general, that may not be the case. But moreover, you have to choose one, and there's different choices of these functions, and that's an extra choice. And basically what the idea is that, so the idea here is that this extra structure tells you how to descend. So if someone gives you an oriented manifold, you choose a framing of it, or at least locally you can do that, and then this extra structure tells you how to undo that choice of framing. All right, so, good. Good, good. Okay, so the cobordism hypothesis so Baez Dolan proof was given by Lurie, and there are new proofs that are in the works these days. Tells us that framed. The frame TFTs, so that's in n dimensions, so n dimensional frame TFTs, so that's a symmetric monoidal functor from the sort of n dimensional version of this, where I have points, one manifolds, two manifolds, all the way up. It forms into an n category. It's symmetric monoidal for disjoint union. And what we're interested in is, what cobordism hypothesis tells us to do is how to classify those. We fix some target category C. So C is some kind of algebraic or simple higher category. I okay, somewhere where we know how to do the algebra that we need, some algebraic higher category, so it should be symmetric monoidal. Sorry, I seem to be getting used to this chalk. It's a little bit hard for my handwriting. So we've picked some C, and then we're interested in invariants that are living in that universe C, and we want a classification. Like here, it turned out that all we had to do was specify this algebra A, and that was sort of where the point went, and then everything else was uniquely determined by it. Not that it's easy to do, but that at least the theory itself was defined once you chose that A. So we want to generalize both to higher dimensions and to an arbitrary symmetric monoidal category. And so the first part of the Cobordism hypothesis is that these correspond to, are given by the fully dualizable objects. Okay, so I'll define those, I'll define what this fully dualizable thing means. But it's a strong finiteness condition. So the fully dualizable algebras are the finite dimensional and semi-simple ones. And in each context, it's a very interesting question. Somebody gives you a C, you want to know what are the fully dualizable objects, because you can then apply the Cobordism hypothesis, get some new TFT. And then oriented ones, oriented TFTs, are given by SON fixed point, homotopy fixed points. Okay, so the group SON acts in a sort of higher categorical way, in a homotopy theoretic way, on the fully dualizable objects, and you want to trivialize that action. So when you're trivializing an action up to homotopy, you're actually giving the trivializing homotopies. So this might sound naively like a condition to be a fixed point, but it's extra structure you have to get. Okay, So the theme, if there's a theme today, it's that these Morita theories, generalizations of these categories of algebras, give rise to fully local TFTs, and what I want to do is look at some examples that are quite natural and figure out what are the fully dualizable objects in there, and thereby we construct some TFTs. Some of the ones we construct in this way are new. Many of them have been expected for a long time to exist, and some of them you can even give formulas for what kinds of invariants they give. So maybe I'll talk about that a little bit towards the end. Give the only real technical definition I'll give is what a fully dualizable object is. The definition I'll give is a little bit non-standard. It's not the one that, for instance, Lurie gave, but it can be seen to be equivalent. So this one I learned from Noah. I think it's in his work with the Chris's. So first of all, in a two category. Right, so let me say right off the bat, so we're working with N categories, so this really technically means that we're in some higher categorical setting of complete Siegel spaces. One really nice thing about the Cobordism hypothesis is that the fully dualizable objects are defined only using a bunch of two categories that you build out of the higher category. So while to make everything that I'm talking about work, you need a lot of heavy machinery about higher categories, the actual stuff I'm going to prove theorems about is always taking place in some two categories that you extract from those. Okay, so you can really work with them a bit better. So to start, as a warm-up, in a two-category C, left and right, left respectively right, adjoint to a morphism F from some X to Y is another. So either F R from Y to X or FL from y to x, respectively. Okay, and so now I'm supposed to write down what FR and FL have to do with F, but I'm going to write down the exact definition of what it means to have an adjoint functor. Okay, so the two category of categories is the prototypical example. So it'll be something that you know quite well. So for instance, there's a co-unit from the identity on X to the composition FRF. There's a co-unit epsilon r from FFR to the identity of X, such that, and it's literally just transcribing the definition of adjoints of functors to a general two category. Okay, so that's a basic example. Okay, so roughly speaking, fully dualizable categories are going to be one such that at every little 2x2 window that you get, every two category that you excise from them has adjoints, and adjoints are just the axioms that you're used to for two categories. So in more detail, let's see. So a two category. So there's another definition. Two category C has adjoints for all morphisms. If that holds for every one morphism, if we have all this structure, and then. Let's see, so an N category now has adjoints for K morphisms. If for all L less than K, strictly less than K, and for every pair of objects, so for every X and Y, which are L morphisms, we have that, so we take Homs from X to Y. Sorry, we fix some morphisms in some lower degree L. We look at the Homs. Now that itself forms a higher category, it will in general be like a K minus L category. But we only look at the truncation pi less than or equal to 2. So now that's a 2 category, and we want to say that this has adjoints for all morphisms. Okay, so it's a kind of inductive definition of what it would mean for a higher category to have adjoints. Okay, and so then we say that a category C prime in C is fully dualizable, or as it may be, K dualizable, if it's not fully dualizable, if it has adjoints. In the above sense. Okay, I'm going to get to the point of why I give this stuff. I'll remind you what the sort of more traditional definition is, and I'll say why I want to do this one. Okay, because here I told you that we're going to classify them in terms of fully dualizable objects, and now I'm going to all this trouble to tell you what a fully dualizable subcategory is. And so a definition, X and C is fully dualizable. I missed something important. Right, so I said that I want adjoints for all L morphisms, but also for objects. That's important. So that is to say that C was a symmetric monoidal category, so I know what it means to say that an an object has a dual. It's like the dual of a vector space is an example. So remember that X in C has a dual, left and right dual. Well, it's basically the same definition, but just one level down. So you have X as an object. You want another object called X dual, maybe X left dual, and X right dual. And again, you ask for the same compatibilities here. Okay. All right, so then with that addendum in mind, X is called fully dualizable if X is contained in some fully dualizable subcategory. Okay, so let me maybe remind you what the original definition that you'll find in Lori's paper on the cobordism hypothesis says. This one may be there as well, but maybe a more typical definition would be to say that you want X to have adjoints, you want X to have duals, and then you want the evaluation and co-evaluation themselves to have duals, and then you want their evaluation and their co-evaluation themselves to have duals, and so on. And that's really all you need to prove the cobordism hypothesis, but if you're working with algebraic examples, it's more natural to find some whole class of objects or some whole class of morphisms, all of which, so that everything in sight has duals. So you want to work with some finite enough setting so that everything has duals. And then the objects that you've chosen to work with, those are going to be fully dualizable objects. So it's slightly, it sounds stronger, but it's basically the same. So I'm going to be focusing on looking at some examples coming from Morita theory and telling you what are some fully dualizable subcategories rather than individual objects. Okay. All right.
Sorry, yeah. Maybe you'll get to this, but like, is there something we should keep in mind as like a classic obstruction to being dualizable?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, right, maybe let me say the even simpler example than this one. So let's talk about objects. So for an object to be dualizable, you want X and you want X dual. Okay. In almost every setting that we're going to see, your symmetric monoidal category has a unit. Okay, so if X dual is going to be reasonable, there's really only one formula that you can give. There's a theorem that this X dual has to just be the internal Hams from X to your unit. So it follows from the dualizability axioms that such a formula holds. Okay, so you always have a possibility for a dual. And then the two things that you want from your dual is you want an evaluation map from X dual tensor X to your unit. And well, you obviously have that. But the thing that is the sort of obstruction is you want to have a co-evaluation map from the unit to X tensor X dual. Okay, I'm not worried about left or right duals because C is symmetric monoidal, so it actually doesn't matter. You want a co-evaluation, and then this needs to fit into what's called sometimes the Zorro axiom, which says that if I, I'll just draw the picture. So it says that if I do a co-evaluation and then an evaluation and I compose those, then this should be equal to the identity. Okay, so for instance, in the category of vector spaces, we ask what are the fully dualizable objects there. You can show that if such a map existed, it would have to be a map from C to a vector space tensor, its dual vector space. And this formula would tell you that it has to send the number 1 to a sum over a basis tensor, its dual basis. And for that sum to make sense, you need to have a finite dimensional vector space. Okay. So that is really, I'm really glad you asked that question, because even in this basic example, you see that what always goes wrong, it's always easy to have an evaluation map, and the finiteness comes in trying to define the co-evaluation map. So basically, as you go up the category ladder, this becomes less and less of a problem, because, I mean, here we're talking about summing vectors. If we were taking the direct sum of vector spaces, then fine, it wouldn't be an issue. So one of the themes is that it gets easier and easier to become dualizable as you work in more categorical sort of language. But it's still always an interesting question to come back to this co-evaluation thing. Yeah. Okay, so in that direction, I thought I would give another example, which is an example that was really thought about carefully. I meant to say that in this symmetric Frobenius algebra, these are basically the mathematical approach to Dyck-Graff-Witten invariants. So the numbers that you would get out from this cobordism hypothesis, if you actually ran it, they're really counting the same invariants that Dyck-Graff-Witten proposed. So often what happens in physics is it goes the other way. People have these numbers that they want to compute, and they ask, can you go down? Can you compute these by going down further and further down? We're kind of starting at the other end of the tunnel and starting with something really basic algebraic and trying to work our way up. Okay. So the next example that is in a very similar spirit is the Turiya-Vero invariants. Okay, and so the sort of mathematical approach to them that I have in mind is a very nice paper of Douglas, Snyder, and Schomer-Pries. Okay, so these are called Turiya-Vero invariants because Turiya and Vero defined them kind of algebraically at the top level, and then it was a question, can you descend them down? On the other hand, Douglas, Snyder, and Schomer-Pries, they found some natural algebraic framework, and they climbed back up the ladder, and then you expect that they match. Okay, so, right, let's see. So I just need to recall briefly, so a finite tensor category. So it's finite abelian. So recall that means that there's only finitely many simple objects. Every object has a finite length extension of in terms of the simples, and all Hom spaces are finite dimensional. So these are tiny little categories, something like Artinian categories. Is finite abelian and monoidal, incompatibly monoidal. Okay, so I won't write down all the what compatibly monoidal means, but you have a tensor product functor, you have an associator, and so on. So you should think like representations of finite groups and their generalizations, and it's rigid. Rigid if, this is quite similar to what we had before, if every x has a right dual and a left dual satisfying the same sort of list of properties. Okay, so again, representations of a finite group is a good example to keep in mind. So what these guys said we should do is we should consider a Morita theory of finite tensor categories. So this has as its objects finite tensor categories. As its one-morphisms bimodule categories. Okay, so in the same way that an algebra wants to act on a vector space, a tensor category wants to act on another category, a bimodule category. And then we get two morphisms being bimodule functors and three morphisms being bimodule natural transformations. Okay, so it's a very natural categorification of what was going on before. And so I would say their main theorem in this paper is the following. So PSPS. Okay, so the objects, A in this finite tensor world is, okay, so one dualizable always. Okay, and that's not really due to them. That's just, that's due to Lorry, if you like. Any algebra is always dualizable, and its dual is just the opposite algebra. So A just gets sent to A op. So what's more interesting is it's two dualizable. If it's rigid, and it's three dualizable if it's fusion. Okay, and so fusion here means semi-simple and finitely many simple. Well, yeah, it just means semi-simple. I've already seen finitely many objects. Yeah, so no, it's not known. Okay, so no, they're definitely not sharp. So, right, so Theo's asking an interesting question, which I'll be dwelling on, which is the way that we're approaching these problems, you find some fully dualizable, you find some category, you prove that it's fully dualizable. There's the converse question, is it the maximal one? And those questions tend to be quite hard. So, for instance, fusion, this nice property that we really want to use, is not a Morita invariant. So there could be two Morita equivalent categories, one of which is fusion and one of which isn't. Therefore, this cannot be the maximal one. So there's an example that was explained to us by Dan Fried. It's in our paper, I think you looked at it.
You know, well, I'll ask the same question when you get to your theorems. So you know if rigidity is sharp?
Rigid is, no, I definitely don't know if it's sharp. I would, there's a related notion which is that the, let's talk about it later. Yeah, I don't believe that it's sharp, but I don't know a counterexample. Okay, so this in particular constructs these Turiya-Biros type invariants. Whereas what they're originally you would do is you would take some three manifold. So this defines you a three-dimensional TFT for the fusion setting. And what you would what Turiya-Biros initially prescribed is you triangulate your three manifold, and then you have this associator, which is just a bunch of scalars that are encoding the structure of the fusion category, and then you assign one of these to each face of a polyhedron in your triangulation, and then you go to town doing some computations, and you show that they're unique. But the sort of thrust of their result is that actually it's fully extended, it's fully canonical. What was being done there? Okay. All right. So how are we on time? So I think I'm going to start to state some of our results, even though I really need to give some more background just so that I don't run out of time. Okay, so so the difference between Right, so what's the difference between the DSPS stuff and the traditional story about Frobenius algebras is what are your coefficients? So it's kind of obvious that a tensor category is like the right notion of an associative algebra in linear categories. So Alg takes place in the category of vector spaces, whereas this finite tensor categories takes place in the category of sort of in the world of finite categories, finite abelian categories. I didn't say, I kind of pulled the wool over your eyes a little bit. I needed to tell you what the symmetric monoidal structure was. So this is what's called the Deligne tensor product of categories. So it's not trivial, but there's some content to even the existence of this tensor product. And then composition of bimodules is defined as a relative tensor product. You have to make sense what you mean by that in the higher categorical setting. So it satisfies some universal property in the same way you would expect. Okay, so right. So we've already seen that V in vect is dualizable. Okay, in this case, it was if and only if it's finite dimensional. Okay, and I don't really like the fact that they have to work with finite categories because I want to do things related to geometric representation theory, algebraic geometry, and so on. And so you basically never will see finite categories appearing. So I want to emphasize that like most of the traditional work about Chern-Simons quantization, Reshetic-Contrive invariance, and stuff, you're always working with finite categories. And we really wanted to move past that to get to some algebraic geometry. So you want to replace this with a better notion. And fortunately, that notion exists. So there's a notion of a presentable category. And you should think about these these are an analogy to finite categories as finite dimensional vector spaces are to complete Hilbert spaces. So in complete Hilbert space, you can sum up infinitely many vectors as long as there's some convergence property. And in presentable categories, you can write down arbitrary colimits. So you could take arbitrary direct sums, arbitrary co-kernels, not kernels. So presentable linear categories, it's some sort of infinite dimensional setting for doing linear algebra. And in particular, pretty much any natural example you can think of is a presentable category. So the category of quasi-cocoherent sheaves on some variety is presentable. Certainly the category of modules for any algebra is presentable. So it's a very flexible notion. It's a bit better than abelian in some settings.
If you assume some like finite collection of things that generate it once you allow the limits, or
yeah. So I think Michael's reminding us that there's functors. So if I have a finite tensor category, I can do what's called the free co-completion. So I use some Yoneda wizardry to embed this into a sort of canonical presentable category. And then conversely, if I take the compact projective objects, then I'll, well, sorry, finite tense, sorry, finite, getting my, if I take the compact projectives, then I land back into a category like this, roughly. That is true, I want the end completion, thank you. So there's something even more basic in here, which there's even smaller categories here that you freely can complete. So there's this universe of completions and co-completions. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Okay. All right, so just to say that presentable linear categories is just a framework for working with things that arise in algebraic geometry. So let me state some theorems and then talk about some context. So So this is with Adrian himself, Noah Snyder. Okay, so the first part is that in the three category tense of presentable tensor categories, we have that if you're rigid and you have enough compact projectives, then you're two dualizable. Okay, I'm going to come back to this enough compact projectives. It's natural. I'll explain why. Rigid, so Michael already foreshadowed what the right notion of rigid should be. So finite dimensional vector spaces are rigid. They have duals. I want to consider all vector spaces also to be rigid. So the collection of all vector spaces is an example of a rigid category for me. And so I don't want to ask that all objects have duals. I want to ask that a generating set of objects has duals. All vector spaces are generated under colimits by their finite dimensional ones, and so that's what rigid means. So if I assume just that and the existence of projective resolutions, then I get two dualizability. And so I'll just put on the same board that I'll recall the DSPS result just for your organization, that fusion implied three dualizable. Okay. So in the tensor category case, we're just saying that basically their second criterion here, rigidity, just it just works in the infinite setting as you would expect. Okay. But what I'm more interested in, what really motivated us, is the following example. So if we look at part two of the theorem in the four category of braided tensor categories. So I haven't told you what this four category is. I'll do that as best I can. So this is a presentable braided tensor categories. Okay, so the first part is that, Lurie tells us, I'll just remind you, Lurie tells us that all objects, all braided tensor categories are two dualizable. Okay, it turns out that our condition from the tensor case carries forward exactly here. So if you're just, this is one of our results, is that if you're rigid and enough compact projectives, then you're three dualizable. If you're braided in fusion, then you're four dualizable. Okay. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about examples in dimension 3 and 4 that were our motivation. In this case, in the braided fusion case, this is very closely related to some unpublished work of Kevin Walker and Fried and Telemann. Somehow, there's these two works. They work on opposite sides of the cobordism hypothesis, but they're very close to this. They from each other. So Fried and Telemann have announced this result, and it's forthcoming, I think. Kevin Walker works on the other side of cobordism hypothesis, and he kind of constructs for you a TFT directly. So he defines what the invariants should be. And these are related to what are called Crane, Yetter, Kaufman invariants.
Sorry, what do you mean they work on the opposite side of the
So Kevin Walker defines you invariants of four manifolds, three manifolds, etc. So their notion of what a TFT is a bit different than the one that I have in mind with the Kobordism hypothesis, but he constructs it sort of directly. So modulo comparing his notion to the standard notion and then accepting the Kobordism hypothesis, then you would know this result. Because he's constructed the TFT, and then that should correspond to dualizable objects. There's a lot of daylight there because of different axiomatics, but essentially that they're ones that he studied. Fried and Telemann, on the other hand, really are making this assertion. Okay.
And fusion in this context means again that everything is semi-simple.
Semi-simple and finite, yeah. Yeah.
Sort of finite is like presentable categories.
They're actually the co-completions, thank you, of something finite. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, so the only thing you've done is allowed infinite direct sums, but you still have finitely many simple objects, and everything still is semi-simple. Yeah, yeah. So these are like, yeah. So somehow real strong finiteness conditions. So they won't appear in algebraic geometry, but the point is that these ones will. Okay. Thank you for the question. Okay, so right before I talk at all about the proof or some of the ideas, at least in the proof, let me say, so to me, this part of the board was the one that was most motivating. So I just want to say why we were doing this, and let me also say while I'm erasing this board that I'm talking to you about the dualizability, but we also care about the orientability of the theory. And so that is, that's work in progress currently with Adrian and Noah. Essentially, we know what to do, but it depends on a work in progress of DSPS. So once they've done their work, then we can do ours. But in the meantime, we've worked out what we need to do. So I can say a little bit about that if there's interest. So the example, so the motivating example, and where I think all the applications of this theorem could be, is a theorem, well, I'll just say a construction that I gave with Benz V and Roche. So we defined a two-dimensional TFT, or rather, we computed with a two-dimensional TFT. So you fix the braided tensor category to be representations of the quantum group. Okay, and this works for any parameters of Q. So Q can be generic, Q can be a root of unity. In any of these contexts, there's a sensible statement to be made. Well, we computed the two-dimensional part of a TFT, and the kinds of answers that we get are somewhat interesting. So there's certain explicitly given algebras that were introduced with an explicit presentation by Alexeyev, Grossa, and Shomarus. Like in the 90s or something. Actually, this paper is impossible. The original paper is by Alexeyev, but it's literally impossible to find, because if you search for Alexeyev, it will not appear. It's somehow in some nether regions of the archive. So you have to search for it by its title to find it. I don't understand why. And then he wrote some follow-up papers with Alexeyev, Grossa, and Shomarus. So these are some explicit quantizations of character varieties. So we had to talk about character varieties this morning. These are some explicit quantizations that you give by generators and relations. We discovered that these things although they're given an explicit construction in their papers, they're universally the output of this TFT. So that's some computation with the two-dimensional part of this TFT. And so most interesting for me is that this is for a punctured surface, sorry. If you look at a closed surface, For instance, if we look, let me specify, if we look at the two torus T2, then you get a category of what are called strongly equivariant DQ modules, DQG modules. And these are some sort of difference operators. So this DQG, the Q means that it's like D modules on G, but Q difference D modules. So instead of taking derivatives, you're doing some discrete translations. And so this category of strongly equivariant DQ modules is some really nice category of modules for a non-commutative algebra. So the reason why this is, I think, interesting in the context of the 3D theory. What I'm implicitly saying is that the 3D theory that you get via this theorem is the extension up one dimension of this two-dimensional theory that we've already been computing with. And this is interesting because this means that if I have, say, if I'm interested in knot invariants, so I have some knot in S3, I can now look at the corresponding TFT on the complement of that knot. And now this is a manifold with boundary, so I can think of it as just defining me an object in the category of the two torus. And so that's to say that, and it's obviously an invariant of the knot. So that's to say that to every knot, I get not a number like you would get from the Jones polynomial, but I get rather a system of Q difference equations that I can study. So I can study not just a single number, but a whole system of equations, and I can do some geometry with that system of equations. Let me just say that this sounds a lot like the ingredients of what's called the quantum A polynomial. So the quantum A polynomial it comes from quantizations of character varieties, just like this one does. And it's specialized to SL2, so that's where the polynomial comes from, that you're only working in rank one. And so the quantum A polynomial is an invariant AQ of a knot that lives in some kind of algebra of difference operators, some Q algebra of difference operators. And this is like a very special case of the sort of structure we're getting here, these difference algebras here. And there's a so-called AJ conjecture that says that you take the Jones polynomial of your knot. It turns out that take the Jones polynomial. You can regard it as carrying an action by difference operators, but that are dilating the quantum parameter here, and this is equal to zero. So that's called the AJ conjecture, that these two invariants are related in this way. So somehow the quantum A polynomial is the D module in which the Jones polynomial lives, if you like. It's the Jones polynomial is the solution to this equation. Okay. So if you want to make sense of that, then you need to, first of all, be able to talk about the three-dimensional theory. And also, this whole story really is most naturally taking place when the quantum parameter Q is a root of unity. So the Jones polynomial, recall that this is constructed in Wittgenstein-Tyrayev theory, so it's in the modular case. In order to be able to get these examples, we needed to not just drop the finiteness, but we also needed to drop the semi-simplicity, because when you work with quantum groups at roots of unity, you get all sorts of more interesting homological behavior. Okay. All right. So that's the context for the result. I want to talk about a little bit about the ideas that go into it. Ben, you seem worried.
Are there enough
representations on the third unit?
Yes, it's the result of Anderson that that there are enough compact projectives.
Yep. This is one of these points where the analogy between quantum groups and representation of algebraic groups and characteristic P breaks down.
Oh, really? I'd love to hear about that. I don't.
Well, I mean, maybe it's more like a logical representation theorem, which doesn't. Right. I mean, the point is it's somewhere between us two.
Hey, maybe we can talk about this more a bit later. Okay. So let me say just a few words about not even a sketch of the proof, but some of the ideas that go into them. So this compact projectives thing, I just want to motivate why it appears. And so I basically learned that I should have this condition from a paper of Theo's. I'm happy to talk about it here. And I'll try and tie it in with Michael's question as well. So right, I said that the difference here is that we want to change our coefficients. So instead of finite dimensional categories, we want to work with infinite categories. And so let me just point out that a finite category always has enough compact projectives. If it's finite, actually, there's a single compact projective that you can produce, and then it's just the category of A modules. This is like, I don't know, Fried-Mitchell or some easy version. This is classical stuff. And so when we move to the infinite case, we ask for enough compact projectives. So I don't know if I call it all right theorem. It's certainly not the main theorem of this paper. And as they explain, it's pretty easy once you have the right statement. But a theorem that I learned from them is that every C, so C is presentable category C is one dualizable if it has enough compact projectives. Okay, I want to give a quick proof of this fact that uses what's called the Ninja Yoneda lemma, which is, so if it's to be dualizable, then its dual needs to be functions, co-continuous functions, from C to the category of vector spaces. So the category of vector spaces is the unit. So this is this you know, you must have this thing. And then again, before we were dealing with the co-evaluation, the issue is to write the identity functor on C. You need to be able to write it as living inside of C tensor C dual. And one proof of the Yoneda theorem in this setting is that you just give an explicit formula for the identity functor. It's a coend over the compact projective generators. So you assume that you have enough compact projectives of X tensor Hams against X. Okay, and so for that, so this needs to be co-continuous, so X needs to be compact projective. And then this is like just a, you know, writing the identity, and you've seen tricks like this before.
Okay.
Right, so they also don't, so Theo was bugging me about the if and only if. They don't prove that it's if and only if here, but if you're Tanakian, if your category is in fact the category of co-modules for a co-algebra, then they prove that it's if and only if. So it's an open question whether this is if and only if. But nevertheless, it's robust enough that we can work with it. What's that?
Do you have any categories in mind that are not?
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah. So all my examples. Yeah, I think that's true. So for all the examples that I have in mind, they're always co-modules over a co-algebra. So then, in that sense, at least this part of the theorem is sharp. Yeah. So at least the underlying linear algebra. I would guess that all the other stuff is sharp as well in that under that assumption. But we could discuss. Okay. So right. So what I didn't do, I'm going to stop now. But what I didn't do is tell you a lot of really nice results of Runa Haugseng and Claudia Scheinbauer and Theo that construct this four category and like what it looks like. Well, I didn't really go into the proof, but we'll stop there.
Questions. So the short I'll ask that. Greg Cooper-Burke decades ago wrote down the various fundamentals for non-semi-simple algebra.
Yes.
One of the things he left open was to like understand them. They didn't seem to be coming from his fantasies.
Yeah.
But I don't know that he ever proved they didn't. He just like
But it's not a quasi-triangular half algebra, right? It's just a non-semi-simple. So I want to say that that's I want to say that's more closely related to the Tri-Vero stuff, but I'm really speaking, really guessing here. I thought that the calculus there was
like
not
the
using.
Tri-Vero, but I mean, I think it specializes in Tri-Vero when it was semi-simple.
Yeah. Okay.
But does this stuff like explain where is the variance where we see it?
Well, let me emphasize that if it's related to Tri-Vero, then already DSPS can study non-semi-simple. It needs to be finite. That's to get two dualizability. So to get three dualizability, yeah, they don't. No, I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe we could talk about it. Yeah. It could be related to this. You could take the Drenfeld center of that thing and then get a three. Yeah, I don't know. We could talk.
Maybe I'll just ask this and then you can explain it something offline.
Okay.
So for these non-semi-simple examples in your world, do you have nice descriptions of the vector spaces they assign to three manifolds?
Well, generally, no. Yes, that's a good question. So, I mean, here, for services, because of this vectorization homology machinery, we could compute everything quite explicitly. For three manifolds, as you know, we can conjecture how they look. It's it's weird question because it's what you conjecture in your paper, that they're
conjecture is something not like one units.
Yes, sorry, so right. So in the semi-simple case, you can conjecture what the vector spaces look like. And in the non-semi-simple case, that conjecture is obviously wrong. And so what exactly the invariants look like in three dimensions, no. If your three manifold is built out of surfaces in some reasonable way, like you take a mapping cylinder or something, then you can certainly make natural guesses. But yeah, I agree. It's a quite interesting question to sort it out. I mean, something like this AJ conjecture. I mean, I didn't mean to imply that we proved the AJ conjecture, but something like that gives you a guiding idea because then these quantum A polynomials, as far as I understand, they're just defined in a sort of physics-y kind of way. And they give you some formulas that you look at it in some example and you see it works, but you don't have a general framework. So anyways, you could look at those examples and try and hope that that's a description. No, it's a good question. I don't know in general.
I mean, sort of also an odd question to ask because presumably you've talked to him about it, but what's the relationship of this Peter Samuelson's work?
With Peter's work, that's sort of, I mean, Peter works in this area, so I think the answer to that question is really the same as the answer to Theo's question, but I'll try and say it in a different way. So, if I have a three manifold, so something that's not at all clear is that, from what I've said, but is follows from the axioms, is that if I have some surface, I choose a bunch of disks in there, and I choose a bunch of objects of my braided tensor category to mark at each of these disks, then functoriality of the the functoriality of factorization homology gives me some associated object in there. It's just the functor applied to this disjoint union of disks. And so now if I have some three manifold, you know, general three manifold, not just a cylinder, and I have a bunch of these guys, and I should say these guys are compact projective objects in the category if you're semi-simple. If your input category is semi-simple, these are compact projectives. Otherwise, there are dragons. But so if you're semi-simple, then these are compact projectives, and then I have some similar compact projectives down here. And so the expectation, which I learned about from a paper of Theo's, that how you would connect this to like old school skein theory, is that you can't skein. There's not a functor on the skein categories. But what you can do is you can take this object in the input and these objects in the output, and I can tell you, so, and this three manifold M is supposed to find me a functor. I can't give you a formula for the functor, but what I can give you a formula for is HOM of F of the input thing with the output things. And this is the skein module. Relative skein module, it's called. So Peter thinks a lot about these relative skein modules. I guess that was the thrust of your question.
It wasn't the thrust of my question.
Oh.
Peter, like, his thesis was about, you know, associating modules over certain Chorednik algebras.
Yeah, but they're as skein modules. They arise as skein modules, yeah. Yeah. I guess originally maybe it was defined in some more, yeah, more recently he's been thinking about skein modules, but... So the answer that I would want to give is that sort of the skein modules that you might define in some, you know, linear algebraic way are the vector spaces that you're getting by homing these things. So they're the matrix coefficients, if you think of HOM as an inner product on a Hilbert space. So this was Theo's conjecture. So maybe that wasn't the answer you were looking for, but it does answer your question in the sense that, well, since writing his thesis, he understands, he thinks about them in terms of skein modules. So, yeah. And in some small examples like SL2, SL3, I can confirm these kinds of correspondences. Somehow the issue with higher rank is rather that people, you know what a skein module is, but it's quite messy to actually do anything with it, so nobody really done much with general things besides SL2 and SL3. So, yeah. I mean, that's not fair. People have done a lot, but as far as making a meaningful statement here, the examples are in SL2 and SL3. Or, what we're working on with Peter now is just to advertise is GLN as n goes to infinity. So, you know, Berman and Schiffman introduced these elliptical algebras, and then Schiffman and Bassereau tell you that the spherical Daha is sort of in the limit as n goes to infinity gives you these elliptical algebras. And so a sort of conjecture that we're working on with Peter is that if you take sort of RepQ GLN as n goes to infinity, you get the Homfli category. And if you take its factorization homology, so that's actually a semi-simple category. It's a pretty reasonable category, semi-simple, that it will produce you the elliptical algebra. So the two parameters, Q and T, are, well, I can maybe explain how they come. Q is obvious. T has to do with some marked point that you put on the torus. So yes, of course, we talk with Peter about this a lot.
Let's thank David again.